Your relationship with your body is the longest relationship you will ever be in. You must have unconditional permission to eat in order to make peace with food. What is your self-talk like about your body? If you wouldn't say that to a loved one about their body, what makes it okay to say it to yourself? This is a safe virtual space where we are going to dig into deep heart-to-heart combos that all come back to our relationships with food and body. Welcome back to another episode of the Find Food Freedom Podcast. This is your host, Sam Previtt. I'm delighted that you're here, and I'm extra excited today because I got to do a guest interview today. I'm usually solo, but I really was excited about today because we got to speak to Natalie Alibrandi, who is a London-based food scientist, entrepreneur, and CEO with over 15 years of experience in fast-moving consumer goods, spanning quality assurance, R&D, innovation, and marketing. Natalie brings a unique global perspective to conversations about nutrition, wellness, and the future of food. She now leads Nali Consulting, where she helps small brands and startups formulate, package, and scale their innovative food and drink products for launching. I was so excited to talk to Natalie because, as I am sure you have experienced, there is so much bullshit on social media. And Natalie is just so brilliant as a food scientist. Instead of having to read all the research, we just got to ask her the questions. If you've ever wondered about natural flavors, MSG, just different regulations in the US versus the UK versus the EU, so many myths are busted. I don't know, that just sounded wrong. I don't know, guys, I haven't finished my coffee yet. But I will say, just Natalie's incredible. I feel like today's episode, I was just firing questions at her from all cylinders, trying to utilize all the time I had with her. If you're someone who's been wondering about different products, ingredients and products, how our food is on the shelf, just all of the things, you're going to want to check this episode out, and you're definitely going to want to check out Natalie as well. So without further ado, let's get into it today with Natalie. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on today, Natalie. I have so many things I want to ask you, and I feel like this is such a timely interview because in the age of social media, there is so much misinformation flying everywhere. So I want to hear from you when it comes to how do I word this? The biggest piece of misinformation that you've seen lately about nutrition. Maybe you were scrolling on your FYP. Maybe you were watching the news. I don't know what it was, but maybe you saw it in a magazine. What was something that kind of stopped you in your tracks and you're like, wow, that is incorrect?
Yeah, it's really difficult to just pick one. Let me be honest with you.
You can pick top three, whatever you want.
Yeah, there's so much misinformation that is getting out there, unfortunately, these days. I see it pretty much every day on social media. But on the flip side, I will say there is a lot of good information also out there, too, especially with channels like this. But yeah, in terms of misinformation, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of it in the U.S. right now with different politicians deciding to speak up about nutritional aspects. Wouldn't really recommend any sort of guidance that they provide. It's difficult to say, but as a consumer myself, of course, you know, you sort of want to take your, you know, health and guidance from yourself. You know, you have to be your own advocate and you need to educate yourself about how to read, packaging labels, what's right for you and your body, you know, so like a vegan diet might be good for someone. It might not be good for someone else. And that's, you know, with everything when it comes to food. And when it comes to, yeah, some of the information that goes out there, sometimes it's good to fact check it as well before you just sort of decide to alter your life for some new diet or purchase some new product. Do a little bit of digging on it first.
I love that you said that. And thank you for just right out of the gate being like, there's some politicians that I would not recommend getting nutrition advice from, because I support that message as well. And I think what's hard is I truly believe that so many people, like you just said, like they want to genuinely better their health physically, mentally, emotionally, and they get lost in these misinformation spirals. And I see it all the time being on social media. I get so many trolls in my comment section and people saying like, I did my research and they're coming to these conclusions. And now I feel like research just means like watching a TikTok video. So when it comes to nutrition information, labeling information, like, are there any gold standard places that you recommend people? Obviously, like certain professionals with credentials, but is there any different areas that you recommend being like, this is a great place to go and get information from?
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point. You're right. A lot of people think that they do their research and it's just through other social media networks. Obviously, some of the gold standards are getting scientific literature, right? So think of PubMed, you know, really accredited institutions. But it's very difficult to read through that literature. And, you know, a lot of it is behind paid walls. But, you know, I always think of EFSA, you know, in terms of putting out good communications on guidance. So think of like, yeah, EU standards, I would always say are pretty gold standards to use and to look there first. But, you know, it's not always perfect. And to just know that. And sometimes there's even things that EFSA are now, you know, realizing that they should be changing about the laws from, you know, the last couple of years with new nutritional information because things are constantly changing.
Yes. I love that you bring that up. Things are ebbing and flowing. Things are changing. New research is coming out. And do you mind spelling out that acronym or like what that means, that organization, so we can make it clear for listeners?
Sure. It's the European Union. Okay. So it's called EFSA, which is the Food Regulations Agency for all of the European Union.
Awesome. And now I know you and I were chatting before we clicked record that you're based in London currently, but you've also lived in the US and kind of on both continents, if you will. But so when it comes to the US versus EU and UK, I feel like that's something I constantly am seeing in this wellness nutrition world is people are saying how the regulations in the US are so, for lack of a better word, shitty compared to European standards, whether that's a beauty product or a supplement or food. So can you tell our listeners, like, what is that true? Or like, what are the differences between regulations in the US versus over in Europe? And just any light you can shed on that or myth busting.
Yeah, absolutely. I've experienced it firsthand. Obviously, things are much more strict in Europe and in the UK than in the US. But I always like to start out by just talking about the different types of checks and balances. So the checks and balances in the UK and the EU are really government regulated and through also councils and different types of sort of regulatory agencies that will see products out in the marketplace and will contact these brands and say, you know, what nutritional values you're putting out there don't exactly align with the labeling that you have, or you know, something along those lines, and they'll sort of call them out and make sure that they're abiding by the regulations in place and making sure there isn't sort of marketing puffery around some of these claims. So that's sort of the way checks and balances work in Europe. Whereas in the US, the checks and balances, I like to say, is really between the consumers. So if you're a brand and you're putting something out there, you want to make sure you're doing your due diligence and you've got the data to support your claims, because, you know, the checks and balances there is that you might end up getting a lawsuit and your brand could tank overnight because of social media and because of the claims that you're trying to make. So it's just a little bit different on both sides of the pond. But when it comes to, you know, is one side sort of better than the other? I mean, the EU does obviously have a lot of regulations in place, but the downside to it is that sometimes innovation isn't as quick, right? So there could be something out there. It could be an ingredient. It could be a product. And maybe the EU hasn't signed off on it yet. So it could be a good product. Again, is it a novel food or is it just something that is a new process? Difficult to sort of say a one size fits all there. But it could be a good product. So even if it's not regulated in the EU, doesn't mean it's good or bad. But on both sides of the pond, you know, the EU generally does have, you know, a higher good food safety, good nutritional products that are being put out there. And I like to think of it quite holistically, that it's not just about, you know, oh, this ingredient is banned in Europe. That's what a lot of people think. It's sort of like from the farm all the way through to getting the product on the shelf, right? So traditionally, there are less pesticides used on agricultural crops in Europe. You know, maybe they're going to take a better, more clean approach to food safety as well. There's a lot more aseptic goods that are produced in Europe than in the US. And a lot of this has to do with certain brands that have been very popular and sort of led the way in manufacturing. So generally, you know, it can be better, but it also depends on each individual country too, because the EU is a big place and there's always a lot of local regulations to each one as well.
Thank you so much for stating all of that. And I think it's so important to hear from you this information. So I want to circle back to when you say in the US, it's like the consumer is doing the checks and balances, right? Is how you stated that. Can you expand on that a little bit? Like, for the most layman terms. So let's say a product comes out with a specific claim. Maybe you could give an example of, and if there's any, I don't know if you want to name drop a specific product, but if I'm sure you have seen many lawsuits or products tank overnight where something was claimed and then it came out that it was false, or there was something, let's say, miscommunicated by a product. Any more light you can shed on that, I would love to hear about.
Sure. So the most recent that I can think of is the lawsuit that happened with Poppy. So, you know, that there was a declaration of lower amounts of fiber than initially stated. You know, again, these things happen a lot in the industry. But yeah, in the US, it traditionally has been more from consumers. And that just has to do more with the fact that you consume more easily in the US than you can in Europe or in the UK as well.
Yeah. Interesting. Thanks for shedding light on that. So for the, I want to kind of stick on the US for a second on how in this MAHA movement, I'm going to use heavy air quotes of Make America Healthy Again here. They are celebrating, or over the past of the course months, they've been celebrating removing certain dyes and foods, or food ingredients, excuse me, from different products, such as like Hershey's, there's been from Smucker's, like all of these different ultra processed foods. They're removing these things and they're celebrating this as a great win to make America healthy again. But I love how you are also shedding light on how different the food environments are from the US to Europe, where you were saying, you know, over here in Europe or UK or EU in general, it starts all the way at the farm, right? So maybe they're not using as much pesticides, or just like farm all the way to the shelf. There's different things happening. Any light that you can shed on just the experience, the information, the education that you have of how different the food environments are in general, between the US and EU? And do you believe that removing some of these ingredients is exactly what needs to happen to make huge strides in the general health of citizens?
Sure. I think a lot of it comes down to needing more education on the consumer level, you know, that your diet should consist of predominantly whole foods. Obviously, you know, removing some of these dyes can seem like it's a really great win. And it's good to sometimes question things that are already out in, you know, the marketplace, and to see, even though we've been producing it for a while, is it still, you know, a good product to be putting out there? But these dyes, and, you know, I always think of like the natural flavor movement and things like that, they're used at such a minuscule amount in a lot of these products. So if you think of it, you know, look at what is 99% of the rest of the formula. That would be more of a priority to me than looking at something that's just adding, you know, color or flavor, and to look at the rest of the formula and what it consists of.
Yes. And thank you for stating that. And accessibility is something I wrote down too while you were speaking. Is, you know, you're someone who's lived, did you say you lived in Europe for over 7 years now? Mm-hmm. 7 years, right? So you've been in London versus the US. Do you, just out of even personal experience, do you see a difference in the accessibility that you have to Whole Foods? Because that's something, you know, often I talk about on our page, or in our organization, when we're looking at the social determinants of health and just the access to Whole Foods and the way that our environment is set up. Do you see a difference over in London of like having more access to fresh foods than US?
I personally do, but I think access in terms of affordability.
Yes.
So when I first moved over here, I decided to conduct my own experiment, which was, you know, just buy some bread, some eggs, some milk, and see how much it costs. And it was basically a fraction of the cost of what I used to pay in New York.
Yes.
So, you know, I think a lot of people have this perception that Whole Foods or foods that are supposed to be better for you need to be premium, need to be extremely expensive. But if you're really, you know, smart with your choices, as well as looking for affordable options, you know, they can be out there. But I do see more of a difference in Europe than in the US. I always like to use the example too of blueberries. buying a pint of blueberries in the UK, again, is just so much more affordable than buying a pint of blueberries in New York.
It's so funny that you bring up blueberries, because I have two toddlers, and the amount of fruit that we buy in this home, I'm like, people think you spend money on diapers or like toys with kids. I'm like, no, it's fruit. Like, we're going to like go under because of fruit. Also, my dog has some disc issues, and so we give him his little pills and blueberries, and every blueberry I give him, I'm just like thinking about like, this is so much money, which is ridiculous. But that's so important to state, because when we look at health and we look at like what determines our health, you know, our access to this food, like you said, of affordability, our socioeconomic status, and being able to afford food and get to it, to drive to it, right? To have gas, like all of these things. Life is very, very expensive right now. So, one thing that you had said previously, I love that you brought up natural flavors. This is something that, as a dietitian, I can't tell you how many people bring up natural flavors, or I see it all over the internet, or I see some of these, I don't even know what to call them anymore. I guess we could call them influencers, like health gurus, heavy air quotes. I'm sure you see this all the time, where they're like going through Costco and they're like picking apart ingredient lists. Can you just tell our listeners what are natural flavors in a product? Like, what are they? Should we be afraid of them? Like, just give us the breakdown about natural flavors.
Sure. So I always like to use the example of an orange. So if you pick up an orange, you'll have a little bit of oil residue on your hands. So you're basically taking the orange peel and you're pressing it and extracting it for its essential oils and for all of the volatiles. And then to make sure that those volatiles and essential oils are going to stay, you know, basically in a liquid form and to be using them for applications, you compound them with different types of solvents. So depending on the natural flavor business and what the natural flavor is and where the oil came from, You can be adding in alcohol, you can be adding in propylene glycol, all different types of solvents, glycerin, etc. They can also be, of course, dehydrated, which basically makes a spray-dried natural flavor. Natural flavors have been around for nearly 100 years now, and sort of the, you know, OGs of natural flavors were people just, you know, in their home using different types of spices and just grating orange peel to add into different types of baked goods. So it's just that we've applied more science to be able to use them more universally. But natural flavors are traditionally used at, you know, anywhere from 0.01% to give you an example. So again, when I see a lot of consumers that, you know, want to ban natural flavors or want to ban, you know, these types of products, why don't you look at the 99.9% of the rest of the formula and focus a little bit more on that than some of these sort of top notes that are really just contributing to the flavor or the color of the product.
I can imagine, like, I think of me as a dietitian, the amount of times I roll my eyes looking at social media, but I can't imagine how much you see that you just have to take a deep breath and be like, wow, like, we are focusing on the wrong thing. I guess I want to do like a lightning round of ingredients that I think about, like, it's kind of like diets, right? That they go through phases of like, what's the hot diet that everyone's trying to do, or fad diet. I feel like ingredients are the same, where there was like these waves of ingredients that everybody was watching out for. I guess MSG is coming up for me. Can you educate us or our listeners a little bit about what MSG is and if we should be concerned about that in our products?
Sure. I mean, it enhances the flavor of your product. So through the umami flavor, and, you know, it's traditionally used in a lot of Japanese and Korean cooking. You know, I know it's very, you know, consumers in the U.S. are very scared of it. But when you look at other countries, they've been using it historically for centuries. And there isn't really much scientific literature behind the backing of it to be banned, especially in some of these countries, like I said, Japan and Korea, that have really high food safety standards in place and really high quality standards in place. But yeah, I've seen some products now and brands that are trying to change the narrative on it and coming to light as well.
Yes. How about seed oils? I'm sure, like, this is one I think I see everywhere. A lot of these wellness gurus are tearing apart different products in the store or just seed oils in general. Would love to hear your take on that.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
fine, if I have to.
We can talk about seed oils again. Yeah. I mean, people are concerned about it because the high amounts of omega-6 and that it could be causing inflammation. But again, you want to be looking at how are these seed oils being used, right? You know, what's more of a cause of concern, I would say, is if people are using some of these seed oils at home and they're going past their smoke point. And, you know, they're using them at really high temperatures. But again, it depends on the seed oils. I mean, they're all different. There's so many different types of seed oils. You can't generalize for each one of them. And again, it depends on the application and why are you looking to avoid them? I mean, do you actually have an autoimmune disease and, you know, you've been informed by a dietitian or nutritionist to remove them? Or did you just see about it on a social media post and think you should be banning it from, you know, your foods? I mean, they're very versatile products. Seed oils are in a lot of different types of products out there. They could be in beverages to confectionery products. And they have a lot of different types of versatile components to them. So yeah, it's like everything out there, you know, all of these different trends. It's just sort of a matter of, is it trendy to ban it or not?
Exactly.
But is there actually scientific literature on removing of some of these products? Typically there isn't.
That's what I'm so grateful to have you here for, because like you said, going through and combing through all of this literature can be really hard, and that's like a skill set and something we have to learn. So to be able to ask you and just hear it straight from you is so incredibly helpful. So we've talked a lot about ingredients, but I want to talk about products. And I know that's something you really specialize in. And we see these again, unfortunately, we have to go back to social media because this is where people are getting their information. So thinking of things like functional mushrooms, matcha, electrolytes, plant-based protein powders, or like greens powders. Definitely in the past few years, I've seen a huge rise in these products. So we'd love to hear from you your thoughts on these products and if someone is going to take one of these products or start to try them, what they should be looking for on a label with these products.
Yeah, sure. So maybe let's talk about the first one, functional mushrooms. So personally, I'm happy to see functional mushrooms really getting into mainstream. I think there was a lot of stigma around mushrooms, and they're really such powerful, fungi. So they should be out there, and you can see them anywhere from beverages all the way through to, you know, confectionery products and protein bars and things like that. And there's many different types of functional mushrooms, right? So there's reishi, there's chaga. So some of them can sort of uplift you, and some of them can keep you more relaxed and support in anxiety. But when looking at, you know, a formula, so let's say like a ready to drink coffee product, you want to be looking at just overall a clean label product. So again, you are going to be looking at, can this product be a little bit lower in sugar content? But it really depends on what you're looking for to get out of that product, right? Are you having it as your morning cup of coffee, or is this your afternoon pick-me-up? Maybe you do want some sugar in it if you're going to have it right before you're going to work out, you know? So it really depends on the individual. But overall, I'm happy to see that functional mushrooms are starting to be more mainstream now.
Yeah, great to hear. And I mean, I love mushrooms as the food. It's actually funny as you say that, I have a bag of like functional mushroom gummies over there. And I'm like, oh, I need to pop some of those right now while we're talking. But when it comes to, I want to talk about plant-based or some of these greens powders. And one thing I'm thinking of, you know, as dietitians, anytime a client comes to me and they want to take a supplement, I'm definitely a food first kind of gal, but I think supplements can absolutely be used to fill in gaps. And there's so many behaviors we can look at before we add in supplements, but I'm really big on recommending that a supplement is third-party tested. So whether it's NSF or Sport Informed, or is it Sport Choice? I'm totally forgetting the one right now. But I would love to hear from you, like with EU versus US, with third-party testing on certain supplements, is there a difference there? And what are certifications that you recommend that people are looking out for in their supplements?
Sure. So traditionally, when a brand is just getting started, a lot of the time they're not going to have a full R&D team.
Of course.
So they are already sending out a lot of products to third-party testing. So this could be the likes of Eurofins. They're one of the largest third-party testing facilities in the world. So it doesn't necessarily need to be NFS verified and, you know, tested. But again, it's up to the brands to be able to test the products, but it's in their best interest. So that way they've got the right information for their nutritional label and for packaging and claims. So a lot of it is already happening behind the scenes. It's just sort of a matter of if these brands are trying to promote themselves that way and give you sort of the back end access. But I am seeing a lot of that now, especially in the supplement space, because, you know, supplements are not regulated by the FDA. So a lot of these supplement brands are trying to get more trust from their consumers by putting some of these tests sort of out there and available. But again, each brand should already be sort of doing this. In the EU, it's the same thing as well. You'd be using a lot of third-party testing if you don't already have that testing available as part of your laboratory. So it is sort of the same protocol. When it comes to labeling, you know, certifications are a lot more popular in the US than the EU. So certifications like USDA Organic, Non-GMO Project Verified, Vegan Certified. Again, it just depends on what you're looking for, you know, from a supplement or from another product too. And then some of the grocery stores are also trying to take the responsibility on their side, you know, So Sprouts, Whole Foods, you know, some of these grocery stores like to do sort of their back end due diligence. Mm-hmm. Again, it's to protect themselves. So that way they know that these brands are doing all of the testing that they can internally or externally to be able to support the claims and the product and make sure everything is safe for consumption.
Yes, that is great to hear and great to know. And speaking of foodborne illness and safety, I feel like we have had a major, major rise across the pond over here in the U.S. of different just outbreaks of foodborne illness. And whether it's lettuce or frozen waffles or you name it, can you speak to a little bit about why that may be and just how consumers can try to be as safe as possible? Because I know it can be scary to eat when you feel like every time you're opening your phone, you're seeing a recall from a grocery store.
Yeah, absolutely. It is really scary what's happening out there, especially when consumers think that they're bettering themselves mm-hmm. by eating a salad, right? And to know that you could get some sort of foodborne illness that way. The reason why it's happening, particularly with lettuce, is that it's just in too close proximity to where there's cattle being farmed or other animals being farmed, and they don't have separate sort of water streams. So there can be cross-contamination that's happening within the irrigation systems. And there's no kill step with lettuce because you're consuming it raw. Mm-hmm. So that's why it can be of a greater risk than some of the other products or agricultural products out there, because if they're being made into maybe a beverage or they're being made into something else and there is a pasteurization step, for instance, then this is going to protect it from that microbiological load.
Yes.
For ways to try to protect yourself as a consumer, with lettuce in particular, try to get it to soak in water for at least 10 minutes and to really make sure it is thoroughly cleaned, make sure there's no sort of soil residue on it is sort of the best that you can do. And to try to choose maybe from local farmers that I know it can be difficult, mm-hmm. But some of the big brands out there that are getting these, terrible foodborne illnesses out there, maybe staying away from them and to try to choose other farms that have better practices.
Yes. I love, first of all, that's a great tip of the soaking the lettuce. I think a lot of people wash their fruits and vegetables, but sometimes it's like a quick rinse. And so that is helpful mm-hmm. to hear. And it can be fun. It can be difficult depending on where we live. And again, that comes back to privilege and accessibility. But I think like trying to shop local and find local farmers markets and supporting local, I think can be so, so crucial and important. So I feel like I could keep you here all day and asking you so many questions. Thank you for, I feel like this has been a very firing at you. I feel like I'm usually more conversational, but I just have so much I want to learn from you. So before we leave today and kind of close this out, what do you think the future of food and food trends, what should we be looking out for? What is on the horizon already that we might not know about? Or what do you foresee in the next coming years with food and products in general?
Yeah, absolutely. It is an exciting time for food. I think that there's a lot of new food solutions that are starting to happen and to come into place. So for instance, with upcycled foods, so products that were traditionally discarded of, finding a new home for them, I like to call it. So you can see this with banana peels that have then been upcycled and fermented to be able to make alcohol, or different types of BSG, for instance, brewer spent grain, which is the residue from the brewing industry being made. And using that fiber and protein content again for different types of products, from beverages all the way through to confectionaries. So there's a lot happening in that space right now. I mean, the OG of upcycled was just whey protein. So okay. It was the water and the whey that's coming off of the cheese production. And obviously it's made a multi-billion-dollar business globally. So it just goes to show you though that you can convert something that it is waste into some really functional products, and they can be traditionally very versatile as well. So that's one big segment that is happening. Also just the future of functionality. Consumers are really demanding a lot of functionality from everything from beverages, you know, to skincare products. They want to simplify their lives and, you know, multiple steps and things that they're eating. They want a lot of functionality from whatever they're consuming. So you're seeing blurred lines that are happening within segments of the industry. And you could see one product, it could be an RTD beverage, you know, with different, we're seeing sparkling waters, right, with prebiotics, probiotics, postbiotics in it. So a lot happening within the gut health space. The power of protein, of course, and fiber, which is now getting its new marketing push. Thank goodness.
A moment. I feel like we're going from protein to fiber is like the star of the show this year.
Yeah, I like to think that people thought about it because, you know, if you eat too much protein and not enough fiber, you're going to have gastrointestinal issues. So absolutely. People have unfortunately learned the long way, but now fiber is having its moment. But you need to also make sure you're not having too much fiber too. So everything within balance. Yeah. So these are some of the segments and categories that we're starting to see really play out over these next 5 to 10 years.
That's awesome. That's so cool to hear. And I love really how you're sharing about the upcycling and how waste can really turn into something extremely nutrient dense, like a waste of a product, right? And how we can reuse it and recycle it and upcycle it, as you said. So for anybody who's listening who wants to learn more about you, where can they find you? And are if you want to also just shed light on the services that you offer to different people who are maybe have an idea for a product or something. I would love to hear more about that as well.
Sure, absolutely. So you can just get in touch with us through our website. So nollyconsulting.co.uk, and I'll send this on over to you as well to shed a little bit more light on our services. So a lot of the companies that we work with could be as small as a startup all the way through to a Fortune 500 company. So there isn't one size fits all. And it could be going from a concept all the way through to commercialization. So getting a product on shelf, on e-commerce, in food service, or just also supporting in sort of one segment of the innovation puzzle. So maybe you need help because you run into formulation challenges. Maybe you need support on just shelf life studies or the nutritional and labeling guidelines, which can be very difficult to navigate. So you can get in touch with us and we can discuss your project and see how we can support you further.
That's incredible. So, so cool. It's been such an honor to learn from you. And as we leave today's episode, I know this is hard because we fired off so many different questions, but what would you like to leave our listeners with? If we're thinking labels, we're thinking misinformation, we're thinking all the things we talked about today, if they don't remember anything and they remember one thing, what is one simple message you would want them to walk away with?
Yeah, it's a good one. I just always think people should be their own advocate for their own body and health. So again, making decisions on consumer products or diets that are right for them, don't always, just listen to what you might see on social media or on a label. Try to fact check it yourself. I think a good one of that is with the no sugar label in the US. So, a lot of products out there will say no added sugar. There could be naturally occurring sugars in that product. So, looking to the back of the pack, seeing what does it actually contain. I'm not saying that natural sugars are bad for you, but again, making an informed choice on looking at the back of the pack and understanding the product a little bit more, maybe before you pick it up or choose what time you're going to consume it.
Yes. Thank you so much, Natalie.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Find Food Freedom Podcast. Every single time you listen to an episode, it truly makes our dreams come true, helping people make peace with food, body, and movement. If you have not already, please make sure to head over to social media and give us a follow at find.food.freedom on Instagram or Find Food Freedom on TikTok. And if you resonated with today's episode and want more professional support, please head over to findfoodfreedomresources.com. This is where you can get your benefits checked to see if your health insurance will fully cover that one-on-one nutrition counseling with our team. And we also have so many other virtual resources there. So again, that's findfoodfreedomresources.com for all things Find Food Freedom and to get those health insurance benefits checked. If you have not already, I invite you to rate, review, subscribe, like, share this podcast with anybody that you think needs to hear it. The more that you share this podcast, the more that this message of intuitive eating and food freedom will be out in the world, which we so desperately need. Again, thank you for being here. I cannot wait to chat with you again soon on the next episode of the Find Food Freedom podcast.